It is Monday, December the 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, efforts looming to ease tensions in Yemen.
To do whatever possible to put an end to this tragic fighting, which has been going on for too long and at the cost of a lot of casualties as well as starvation.
The plight of the Chinese Uyghurs.
We've begun to see Uyghurs that have been detained in re-education camps, internment camps, seeing them moved from the confinement space, from the prison space, into working spaces.
Also ahead, who let the dogs out, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Fighting has erupted between Shiite rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's internationally recognized government near the strategic Red Sea port of Hodeidah, leaving at least 12 people dead, 25 others wounded from both sides. All of this just 2 days ahead of the implementation of a ceasefire. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Australian National University scholar Amin Saikal if the two sides are simply jockeying for position, or is the ceasefire about to unravel?
Well, it could be both. I mean, on the one hand, both sides are trying to really strengthen their positions before the ceasefire comes fully into effect. Alternatively, it is a very fragile situation, and it could also very easily unravel. But I think there's plenty of pressure on both sides to observe the ceasefire, and at this stage, it looks a bit hopeful and that it could possibly hold.
The Houthis seem to be in good condition with the ceasefire. Should it be fully implemented, they control most of the population areas.
I don't think Saudi Arabia and its backed government in Yemen would be very happy with the situation. They would have liked to really gain the upper hand, particularly at the Hodeidah port. They have not been able to do that. But at the same time, I think the Saudis and their coalition partners are coming under a lot of pressure from Washington to do whatever possible to put an end to this tragic fighting, which has been going on for too long and at the cost of a lot of casualties as well as starvation and shortage of basic commodities and food and so on. So I think the killing of Mr. Khashoggi in Turkey has enabled the American Congress as well as perhaps many people within the President Trump's administration to make use of the vulnerability of Saudi Arabia and put pressure on it in order to bring an end to the Yemeni conflict.
The Security Council is now supposed to pass a resolution that would back deployment of a robust monitoring regime to oversee compliance of the truce. Will this be difficult to do?
It would be difficult, but at the same time, the UN has deployed monitoring forces elsewhere before in the conflict zones. This is going to be very risky, but at the same time, there is definitely a need for such a monitoring team, because if it's not there, it would be extremely difficult to verify which side really violates the ceasefire. So I think for that matter, that resolution needs to be supported unanimously, and therefore the Secretary General of the UN would have to be given the permission to deploy a monitoring force there.
You were talking earlier about international pressure to end this conflict. On Sunday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned if Yemen's humanitarian situation does not improve, 14 million will be in need of food aid in 2019. That's 6 million more than this year.
He is absolutely right. I think the situation is very dire, and I think a humanitarian crisis is already made, but it could really enlarge, and it could involve a lot more casualties as well as human calamities across Yemen. And I think it is very important that this humanitarian situation is addressed as quickly as possible. Otherwise, all the signs are there that the situation could get really worse for the civilian population, and we may have a much bigger tragedy in our hands than has been the case even so far.
Well, the ceasefire that's supposed to go in Tuesday is crucial. The combatants are supposed to hold another round of talks in January on a political framework for negotiations. How likely is that to happen?
I think if the ceasefire holds, the second round of talks will definitely take place. Whether they're going to reach a final settlement, that remains highly questionable, because while the United States is very keen to see an end to this conflict, at the same time, it wouldn't really want to give too much grounds to the Houthis, because the understanding in Washington and, of course, elsewhere is that the Houthis are supported by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the Trump administration is very much opposed to Iranian involvement anywhere in the region, and that includes Yemen.
Amin Saikal is the director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies and a professor of political science at Australian National University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The New York Times reports hundreds of thousands of Muslim Uyghurs who are being rounded up by Chinese authorities are being put in massive re-education camps in western China and are being moved into forced labor. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype about this with Darren Byler, a University of Washington scholar. All of this about the focus on the plight of China's Uyghur population. Byler toured the area of western China in April.
What's happening is something quite new, really just since September or October of this year, 2018, we've begun to see Uyghurs that have been detained in re-education camps, internment camps, seeing them moved from the confinement space, from the prison space, into working spaces, oftentimes really located very close to the camp, so often inside the same compound. And this seems to be the new trend, something that's happening across the province, across the region, is people being moved from prison into labor situations.
The Chinese are saying that they are educating the people to become more valuable Chinese citizens living inside the borders of China by, number one, giving them language, because many do not speak Chinese, and the second, to give them valuable tools. How do you counter that?
That is their approach, is to train people to speak Chinese. In the camp system, Uyghurs are not permitted to use their own language. Instead, they have to only speak in Chinese, and being in order to graduate from the camp system and work and move into the factory space, you need to pass Chinese language exams. So that's the reports we've heard. You also need to pass ideology tests, your political acumen, you proving that you're loyal to the state and that you are repentant for your past, you know, religious behavior, your past belief in Islam, all of those sorts of things.
You apparently spoke to some people who had intimate knowledge of what is happening now as far as the forced labor is concerned. Can you relate that to us?
Yeah, I won't speak in very specific terms because I need to protect the identities of my Uyghur contacts. But what one person told me is that his brother was scheduled to graduate from the camp because he had passed all of these tests of language and ideology. But as he was being released, they then gave him a 3-year sentence of labor in a clothing factory. And he's now working as a seamstress, running a sewing machine in this factory. They also told him that if he works hard, works well, that it's possible he could be released after 1 year and then be placed under house arrest and continue his work in a garment factory. So this suggests to me a few things. One of the things it suggests is that the people that are being sent from the camps into these other spaces are people that are in the most lenient level of the camp, because there's around four levels from what we've heard in the camps, people that are under, you know, stringent guard to the most lenient level. And I think the people that are released, sent to work in factories, are people that are in that most lenient category, people that are seen as pliable and having a potential future as productive workers.
So that could be the very reason the Chinese are doing this. The Chinese are saying that there are some terrorism involved here, or terrorists living among the population. Do they have any validity in what they're claiming?
There has been violent incidents in the past that the Chinese state has characterized as terrorist. Some of them do sort of meet international standards of terrorist activities, but only, out of the many that they label that in those ways, only, you know, a handful. So in general, it's not that. Most people that have, harbored unauthorized religious views are not interested in any sort of political Islam or violent resistance. Instead, they're just interested in understanding what it means to be Muslim and practicing their faith. So the government's reaction to this is quite an overreach in many ways.
Many people say that forced labor brings to mind North Korea and people ending up being killed trying to escape. Is there anything that severe happening in China?
Well, I think they are being held under armed guard in these factory spaces, so it's not possible to leave them. The factories are still part of the prison system. So it is possible. We don't know what conditions people are being held in, how well they're being fed, if they're being compensated in any way. My sense, though, is that moving from the camp system, from the prison space into the factory space, is seen as a benefit, is seen as a by the Uyghurs themselves as something that now they're actually able to do something rather than simply sit in prison. And they are also given more visits with family. And also them talking about there being like a 3-year program in place, that implies something of an end date, that there's eventually Uyghurs will maybe move out of the forced labor system into something else. But of course, they're always going to be watched. I don't think this camp system is going away anytime soon.
Dr. Darren Beiler is an anthropologist and lecturer at the University of Washington. He also told VOA Asia's Ira Melman China has gone from denying the existence of the camps to the stance the camps are being and bringing about positive results.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari host, Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be superstition. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
In the United States, Christmas cards with family photos are very popular, but more than ever, many of these photos include a four-legged member of the family. Of course, that's the pet dog. For the past several years, a dog bakery and boutique in Arlington, Virginia, outside of Washington, has hired a professional pet photographer to take dog photos with Santa Claus. VOA's Deborah Block takes us on one of those photo shoots where the cute pups are dressed up for the holidays.
Who let the dogs out? Who
let the dogs out? There is controlled chaos at Dogma Gourmet Dog Bakery and Boutique in Arlington, Virginia. Here, the dogs are primped, pampered, and pose like fashion models before their big moment in front of the camera. Today, about 100 dogs will get their pictures taken with Santa by a professional pet photographer.
Like the ones where you can see the interaction, where the dog looks like he's having a conversation quietly with Santa. They're part of the family. They should have their Santa photo, just as they should be part of family photos.
And some of them are in family pictures, like Baby's first Christmas. This pup is having his first Christmas with his family, too.
We love Christmas, so we wanted to make some memories with Santa.
Some people bring their dogs every year.
You can get the girls dressed up in their little ribbons and see all the other dogs in their costumes.
Each photo costs $25. A large portion of the proceeds go to several dog rescue groups in the area.
The money goes to help buy food, buy toys, buy crates and kennels for the dogs.
This pet parent wanted her photo of Quincy to reflect both Christmas and Hanukkah.
I put a yarmulke and a scarf on him for Hanukkah because I am Jewish. I celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah, so I wanted him to be able to celebrate both.
It can be a challenge to get the dogs to stay still.
We make sounds that are out of the norm of their daily routine so that it sort of gets their attention. Yeah. Squeaky toys, we just make weird noises with our mouths.
Some of them will jump up in your lap, other ones will run away from you. I get one once in a while that'll bark at me. I've been nipped at a couple of times, but I haven't been bitten.
Mother and daughter brought their dog, Blue.
We came matching in our matching pajamas, and Blue got a little left out on that, but I think he's okay with it.
The little girl tells Santa what she wants for Christmas.
We can do, okay?
She says Blue told Santa what he wants, too.
A cheese ball.
This woman looks forward to sending her pup's Christmas card photo to friends and family.
It cheers everyone up, I think. To see a little pup with Santa.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
I wish you bluebirds in the spring to give your heart a song to sing and then a kiss. But more than this, I wish you love.
Nancy Wilson, who has died after a long illness at her home in Pioneertown, California, was a musical legend. She crossed so many styles of music, jazz, pop, the sounds of Broadway, standards and ballads, all setting her apart. She released more than 60 albums in her 5 decades in show business. She won 3 Grammys and had tons of hits like the song we're listening to, I Wish You Love. Nancy Wilson was a civil rights activist who marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, Alabama. She hosted her own TV show in the 1970s. And born in 1937, she continued touring until 2011. Nancy Wilson called herself a song stylist and explained why in an interview with PBS.
Give me the freedom to be a pop singer, R&B singer, jazz singer. It's really about the lyric as opposed to the melody. And that's my approach to the music, is lyrically.
Sadly so, Nancy Wilson left us last Thursday. She was 81.
I close a fire to keep you warm, but most of all, when snowflakes fall, I wish you love.
A great wish from Nancy Wilson. Hey, listen, everyone, stay tuned because it's the sounds of Otis Redding up next. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft recently completed its 2 billion kilometer, 27-month journey and arrived at its destination, an asteroid named Bennu. From this past August until December, as the spacecraft drew closer to the asteroid, mission operators turned on and pointed 3 of its science instruments toward it to make the mission's first observations. Scientists say they detected the presence of oxygen-hydrogen bonded molecules called hydroxyls. The scientists say this means that at some point in the asteroid's history, the material that makes up this rocky carbon-rich asteroid interacted with water. While the 492-meter-wide asteroid is too small to contain liquid water itself, scientists say finding the hydroxyls indicates that liquid water was present on Bennu's parent body, which was a much larger asteroid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for a little something from the world of music.
Tramp.
What you call me?
Tramp.
Well, you did.
You don't wear continental clothes or Stetson hats.
But I'll tell you one doggone thing. It makes me feel good to know one thing. I know I'm a lover.
Otis Redding was an American soul singer, often called the King of Soul, and renowned for an ability to convey strong emotion through his voice. According to the website for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where he was inducted in 1989, Redding's name was, and I quote from their writings, synonymous with the term soul music that arose out of the African-American experience through the transmutation of gospel and rhythm and blues into what they called a form of funky secular testify.
You know what, Otis? I don't care what you say, you're still a tramp.
What?
That's right. You haven't even got a fat bankroll in your pocket. You probably haven't even got 25 cents.
Got 6 Cadillacs, 5 Lincolns, 4 Fords, 6 Mercs, 3 T-Birds, Mustang. Ooh, I'm a lover.
Trap was a big song for Redding, which he sang with Carla Thomas, who is often referred to as the Queen of Memphis Soul. She was the daughter of Rufus Thomas, the renowned rhythm and blues, funk, soul, and blues singer, songwriter, as well as dancer, DJ, and comic entertainer from Memphis. Another super hit for Otis Redding was I've Been Loving You Too Long.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. And you want to be free. My love has grown stronger as you become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you too long. I don't want to stop now. You, my life has been so wonderful. I can't stop now. You're tired, and your love is growing. I've been loving you, oh, too long, to stop now.
At an early age, Otis Redding sang in a church choir and learned guitar and piano, and from age 10, he took drum and singing lessons. His passion, though, was always singing, and he often cited Little Richard and Sam Cooke as his influences. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay is a song Redding co-wrote with guitarist Steve Cropper and a tune that many consider his signature song.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in,
Then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Otis Redding was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1994, and in 1999 he received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. And in 1967, he died in a plane crash while traveling to performances. He was 26.
So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
I remember as a kid going out on a fishing dock in Texas where I was growing up, and they would be playing these songs, all of Otis's songs, but always this one right out there. It was super special. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I am Steve Norman. We're in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday. Now some more from Otis Redding.
Loneliness won't leave me alone. This 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On December 17th, 497 BC, the first Saturnalia festival was celebrated in ancient Rome. The festival leading up to the winter solstice involved gift-giving and may have had some influence on the modern celebrations of Christmas and New Year's. In 1830, South American liberator Simón Bolívar died. A military and political leader, Bolívar played a key role in Latin America's struggle for independence from Spain. He is considered one of the most influential politicians in the history of Latin America. On this day in 1843, the holiday classic A Christmas Carol by English author Charles Dickens was published. The ghost story proclaimed the need to care for the poor and promoted the joyous celebration of the holiday. The book has been adapted many times to film and stage. In 1903, near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, bicycle manufacturers Orville and Wilbur Wright of Dayton, Ohio, completed the first successful, controlled, powered flight of a heavier-than-air craft. The plane flew 39 meters in just 12 seconds. 32 years after the Wright brothers' historic flight, the Douglas Aircraft Company first flew a DC-3 twin-engine aircraft. More than 10,000 of the planes were built, and some still fly today. On this day in 1969, the U.S. Air Force officially ended Project Blue Book. That was the investigation into unidentified flying objects, or UFOs. Most of the sightings were determined to be the result of man-made or natural phenomenon. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
We'll be right back.
This is VOA News.